The effort to return Alaska's moon rock to the state.
I'm not talking about the law. I'm talking about morality here. That moon rock was given to the children of Alaska.
From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, July 1st. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the state Supreme Court upholds a smoking ban in Juneau.
Secondhand smoke is bad for smokers as well, as all the studies show.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. And by
the Center for Distance Education at UAF, offering access to online courses from any location. Information at distance.uaf.edu/learn.
You might think we're trying to sell you the moon with this next story. A long-lost piece of moon rock given to the state of Alaska by President Richard Nixon more than 40 years ago is now the subject of a legal battle between the state and a former resident turned Deadliest Catch boat captain who claims to have found it when he was a teenager. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more on this truly bizarre tale.
From 1969 through 1972, NASA's six Apollo missions returned to Earth with hundreds of pounds of moon dust. The Nixon White House mounted samples of the dust onto plaques and called them Goodwill Moon Rocks, given to all 50 states, hundreds of countries, and a few individuals. The moon rock Alaska received from the 1969 Apollo 11 mission ended up at the State Museum in Juneau, which loaned it out to other facilities until it went missing in the early 70s.
I kind of figured we're never going to find this moon rock.
Elizabeth Riker is a University of Phoenix criminal justice graduate student from Detroit. As part of a class assignment, she began investigating Alaska's missing lunar fragments. Last August, she wrote about it for the Capital City Weekly.
I got quite a few emails from citizens in Alaska, you know, asking me questions and saying, you know, they remember seeing the moon rock when they were in elementary school, but obviously they all said this was back, you know, late 60s, you know, 1970, you know, that time frame, but nobody had seen it since.
So what do moon rocks have to do with criminal justice? Riker's professor Joe Gutheins is a retired senior special agent with NASA's Office of Inspector General.
I would conduct criminal investigations and civil investigations impacting NASA. And in 1998, I went undercover in Operation Lunar Eclipse to recover the Honduras Goodwill moon rock.
Gutheins says there's no shortage of missing moon rocks, so the investigation assignment is one he commonly gives to his students.
About 160 moon rocks are missing that were given to the nations of the world. And we've also determined that 18 Apollo 11 moon rocks given to the states and 9 Apollo 17 Goodwill moon rocks given to the states are also missing, lost, destroyed, or stolen.
In December, a man named Coleman Anderson filed a lawsuit against the state seeking clear title to Alaska's Apollo 11 moon rock. Anderson claims his stepfather was the curator of the State Transportation Museum in Anchorage when it was destroyed by arson in 1973. In the days after the fire, Anderson, 17 at the time, says he found the moon rock in a trash heap. Daniel Harris is Anderson's Seattle-based attorney.
The curator of the museum basically signed off on him taking them. And they sat in Coleman's basement or wherever for about 30 years, and then he read about somebody having sold moon rocks, and he said, boy, maybe I have something of value here.
According to Harris, Anderson currently resides somewhere in the southern United States and hasn't lived in Alaska for several years. But he was the captain of a Bering Sea crab vessel, even appearing in season one of the reality show Deadliest Catch.
We lost $25,000 worth of crab.
On the black market, moon rocks have been known to go for millions of dollars, so if Anderson is awarded ownership, he could sell the Alaska rock for quite a bit of money. But Harris says his client is interested in cutting a deal with the state.
We're very open to ideas as to how a compromise could be reached.
The moon rock Anderson claims as his hasn't been authenticated. Nevertheless, the state filed a counterclaim against him, charging that he trespassed and assumed ownership of state property without permission. In addition, the state is seeking return of the moon rock and its plaque and damages for the years in which residents lost use of them. Bob Banghart is chief curator of the Alaska State Museum.
I think that would be appropriate if it turns out to be the real thing. It would be, you know, part of the mission for us. We don't like to lose things, no matter how it occurs.
Retired Special Agent Joe Gutines, now an attorney in private practice, agrees.
And I'm not talking about the law. I'm talking about morality here. In my opinion, that moon rock was given to the children of Alaska.
Remember that Honduras moon rock Gutines recovered in 1998? It was the subject of a 5-year court battle before a judge ordered it to be returned to the U.S. government, which gave it back to Honduras. Whether Alaska gets its moon rock back remains to be seen. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
In a case that could have statewide implications, the Alaska Supreme Court today upheld the city and borough of Juneau's smoking ban for private clubs. The Fraternal Order of Eagles sued the city in 2008, arguing the ban violated their freedom of association under the First Amendment of the United States Constitution, as well as their privacy rights under the Alaska Constitution. In October 2009, a Superior Court judge ruled in favor of the city, and the Eagles appealed to the state Supreme Court. City Attorney John Hartle defended the ban, designed to protect non-smokers from secondhand smoke.
There's no limiting smoking per se. It's just indoors in places of business where they're selling alcohol or food and have therefore a high danger of exposing non-smokers to the secondhand smoke. Secondhand smoke is bad for smokers as well, as all the studies show.
The Supreme Court agreed, ruling that the city has a legitimate interest in protecting the public from the well-established dangers of secondhand tobacco smoke. Eagles attorney Paul Grant says the case is now over.
It's always disappointing not to win, but I don't have any quarrel with the court's decision, and they're, after all, the ones that we asked to decide this, and they decided it. So I think as far as the Eagles are concerned, the case is over with, and we'll move on.
The Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the case last September at Juneau Douglas High School as part of its Supreme Court Live program. The Environmental Protection Agency has granted new draft air quality permits for Shell Oil Company to drill exploratory wells off Alaska's coast. They're up for public comment for 30 days, after which the EPA can grant the permits, moving forward on a process halted last year because of environmental concerns. Shell says today's news is a major step forward in their attempts to drill next year. Shell Alaska spokesman Curtis Smith.
This is the news that we've been waiting for. The issuance of these draft permits keeps in motion a critical series of events that will ultimately determine our ability to drill in 2012. So it's good news.
The EPA had initially issued air quality permits to Shell last year for its plans to drill in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas, but environmentalist and Alaska Native groups raised concerns to the Environmental Appeals Board, which remanded the permits. EPA Senior Policy Advisor for Air Issues, Dave Bray in Seattle, says the new permits address the previous problems. He says they reduce the pollution Shell's icebreakers can emit.
This permit now makes them subject to Clean Air Act regulations at an earlier stage in the process, which was one of the concerns originally raised.
Bray says the draft permits also address new standards that have come into place in the past year, but environmentalists say their early read of the extensive permits reveal problems. Brendan Cummings with the conservation group Center for Biological Diversity complains the EPA's permits are business as usual. He says new emission numbers are arrived at by, quote, clever accounting, unquote. Cummings says the EPA has been pressured by Alaska's congressional delegation and state officials to move forward.
It's just come up with a document that it hopes will pass muster and allows it to say yes to Shell.
The public comment period on the draft air quality permits will end on August 5th. EPA officials say any criticisms or challenges are limited to the changes made by the new permits and can't cover things already signed off on. Meanwhile, a major component of Shell's Arctic drilling plan is now bound for Seattle for upgrades. The drill rig Kulik left Unalaska yesterday after being moored there for nearly a year. According to Curtis Smith, the purpose of the upgrades is to reduce the rig's emissions by 90% in preparation for the 2012 drilling season. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a village bakery along the Aleutian chain that's a hit with ferry passengers.
You just keep walking, 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 and then sure enough, there's the little donut shop on the side, and you can smell it the whole way.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by NEA Alaska, promoting excellence in public education for Alaskan children through investment in education professionals. Online at neaalaska.org. And by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
Salmon could soon be on the menu in every school lunchroom in Alaska. University of Alaska Fairbanks researchers are looking into the best ways to improve the diets of Alaska school children, while at the same time strengthening local and regional markets for sustainably harvested fish. KDLG's Daisha Eaton has the story.
Salmon is a huge industry in Alaska, supplying a super nutritious food, but most of it gets shipped out of state. Investigators with UAF's Center for Alaska Native Health Research are looking into how to get some of that fish that would normally be shipped out to stay here and be put into school lunches.
So the long-term goals of this project are really twofold, to increase food security and improve diet quality in Alaskan school children, while at the same time strengthening local and regional markets for sustainably harvested fish.
That's Andrea Berseman. She's heading up the project. Berseman says she's looking into how to make a farm-to-school type program work for fish, especially salmon, which is high in omega-3 fatty acids and vitamin D.
Farm-to-school is a national initiative that's been going on in the country for, I believe, at least 2 decades. And it's a program that connects schools with small farms. Instead of serving produce, we'll be serving fish. House Bill 70 recently passed in Alaska, and that established a farm-to-school program in the state. Fish-to-school programs can fit under the umbrella of farm-to-school. Really, the objective is getting local healthy foods into the school lunch program.
Patty Luckhurst put together a fish-to-school program for Dillingham schools. After running the school lunch program for years, she said she was tired of serving kids farm-raised fish nuggets. So she started talking with fishermen and a local processor, Peter Pan Cannery, who offered to process the fish for free.
Peter Pan designated a tender toward the end of the Red Run, which they do every year now. And we'll take fish from any fisherman. They don't have to be Peter Pan. It's fresh from the bay right to the plate in a matter of days. I mean, we'll get it mid-July. It literally goes from the boat to the tender to Peter Pan. It's processed and put in our freezers.
Luckhurst says the program serves Dillingham City Schools and 9 outlying village schools in Bristol Bay, as well as the Head Start and Senior Center lunch programs. What Luckhurst did in Dillingham was made possible through volunteers and donations. What Persimmon is looking into is how to make a similar program economically sustainable statewide. Quentin Fong, a seafood marketing specialist with UAF, is helping her with the economics and marketing research.
We will be talking to school lunch providers in terms of what would be the right product form, the price they are willing to pay. Then take that information and work with the Alaska seafood processors and value-adding producers to see if they would be interested in supplying salmon to the school system.
Ann Fong says finding out the real cost of supplying salmon to school districts is important. If it costs too much, Fong says the information could be used to create legislation that would give processors a tax break for providing fish to schools. But Berseman says the first step will be meeting with local people.
Our first step is to form an advisory committee that's composed of representation from schools, teachers, students, community members, health departments, And from there, we really want to seek the input from as many people as we possibly can. And I think that's going to be one of our biggest challenges, is making sure that we get everybody's input. I think that's what's really going to make the research project a success.
The research project is funded by the U.S. Department of Agriculture for 3 years. In Dillingham, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The U.S. Coast Guard has made a change of command on the Petersburg-based cutter Anacapa permanent following an investigation last month. The former commanding officer, Lieutenant Matthias Holy, was temporarily relieved of his command on May 30th. Coast Guard spokesman Dana War says the Anacapa was underway from Petersburg doing scheduled engine trials May 30th, and he was relieved of command by the executive officer that morning. War says Hooley was given a breathalyzer test and found to be over the legal alcohol limit.
The irresponsible use of alcohol is it's clearly a threat to safety and the well-being of our shipmates and the public, and it was a tragedy, but it's something that we don't tolerate within the service and serving the public.
Hooley will forfeit a half month's pay for each of 2 months. He has been in the Coast Guard for over 10 years and took over command of the 110-foot cutter in August of 2009. The body of a missing climber has been found on Denali. Mountaineering rangers using a high-powered spotting scope located Jürgen Kanzian's body yesterday. KTNA's Sudia reports.
Thursday afternoon, the park's rescue helicopter and an observer spotted Kanzian's backpack and skis at a rock outcropping near the edge of what climbers refer to as the football field at 19,000 feet. Maureen McLaughlin, park spokesperson, said the images taken were helpful in positively identifying the gear.
You know, we bring those images back and we're able to zoom in quite a bit and verify what we were looking at and make sure it was the same pack that the climber had taken up.
Kanzian appeared to have fallen down a steep rock gully infamously known as the Orient Express and came to rest at an elevation of 15,300 feet. It is unknown how Kanzian fell or why he diverted from his original plans of skiing down from the summit via the West Buttress route.
You know, we don't know exactly what the weather conditions were like up high. We only know what they were like at 17,000 feet. So there might have been, more clouds obscuring his vision.
It's also hard to know how far Kanzian fell, but most likely it was several thousand feet. Kanzian's body is in a location where it can be safely retrieved by ground patrols when conditions permit. This is the sixth fatality on Denali this climbing season and the ninth in the Alaska Range, making for one of the deadliest seasons in recent history. In Talkeetna, I'm Sue Dio.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Annie Feit. This week, we take a ride on the ferry Tustamina, or I should say, we sample a stop on the ferry, a very mouth-watering stop. Every summer, the Tustamina brings passengers to and from the Aleutians, and when it stops in the village of Chignik, the passengers and locals get to trade places for an hour. KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez has this story on the culinary swap between the town's bakery and the McTusty.
Several times a month during the summer, the population of Chignik doubles for a couple of hours. The arrival of the ferry Tustamina brings fishermen, family members, birders, and other travelers to a 79-person town that isn't otherwise known for tourism. More importantly, the Tustamina brings a restaurant with bacon cheeseburgers.
So I will be taking care of the community of Chignik first, and I'll open up a little bit late so you have time to go ahead and take a walk.
At the Chignik stop, dozens of passengers clear out of the ferry, leaving the dining room open for permanent and seasonal residents like Magda Coplin. They come out with stacks of takeout boxes, sometimes trash bags full of them.
We picked up 7 for the grandparents.
Yeah. They're home waiting for their hamburgers.
Yeah, and the 3 kids and us.
And while locals are doing that, there's an exodus from the ferry as passengers like Chris Ann Wilcox head to one single sugary destination.
You just keep walking, 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 and you think you're almost to the end of town, and then you are at the end of town, and then sure enough, there's the little donut shop on the side, and you can smell it the whole way.
She's talking about Janice Carlson's Bakery, a little seasonal shop that turns into a major social hub when it's open.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good, and you?
Wow, I haven't seen you
for years.
Years and years. Are you here to stay for a while?
Janice welcomes Chignik old-timers and first-timers with the same sort of enthusiasm. Her husband is originally from Chignik, and they lived in the town for much of their lives. Now, they spend most of the year in Washington, but still come up every summer so he can fish and she can operate the bakery.
Hi, did you get two maple bars?
Oh, no.
One chocolate and one sugar.
The bakery is a sweet lover's dream. For a small place, the variety is huge. There are maple bars and fruit scones. The cinnamon rolls are the size of a human head, and the donuts are bursting with hand-picked blueberries. On this day, Janice sells about 200 donuts, mostly to Testamina passengers.
Everybody has their favorite, though, you know, and it's different for everybody. And I can usually tell when people come in what they're going to get. Yeah.
Back at the dock, Chignik parents like Robert Carpenter are waiting for their kids to bring back their food from the ferry. Robert first came to Chignik in 1992. But he's been a permanent resident for the past 8 years. He says summers are busy here, and the Testamina visits offer a nice break from routine.
When the ferry comes in, they make a point to have burgers and stuff.
But more than the ferry coming in and the bakery opening up, Chignik summers revolve around fishing.
The fishing thing is what everything's all about.
Most everyone who gets off the Testamina in Chignik and stays off is connected to the fishing industry by job or by family. Cindy Anderson is trying to figure out a way to get out to Chignik Lagoon.
Yeah, my husband certainly isn't going to stop fishing to come get his wife.
No, probably not. Fishing's too good.
Yeah. Oh, let's see. From beginning of May till the end of September, I play second fiddle to fish. I kid you not.
She says at this time of year, everyone in town spends all of their time catching salmon or thinking about catching salmon.
It's an old saying from farmers, harvest, you know, they do it in the sunshine, and then that's the harvest for the year. Well, in Alaska, when you make hay, well, the sun shines all night long. So when you fish all night sometimes and all day, and then you're like bears in the winter, you hibernate.
And that kind of helps explain why the Testamina's dining lounge is so popular here. When everyone's busy, takeout is convenient, and when the salmon and money are both coming in, it's a nice little luxury. Mark Lisberger is the chief steward aboard the Testamina. He says that the ferry has served as a sort of traveling restaurant along the Alaska Peninsula and Aleutian chain for about a decade. It even has a nickname now, the McTusty. Sometimes, the number of burgers they sell in a place outnumbers the people who live there.
When they're in full swing, we'll pump out anywhere between 60 and about 85 meals in less than an hour.
But while the Testamina is known for its fast food, that's not the only thing that people order.
They order a lot of salads out here, produce and quality produce, I guess would be the key word, being at a premium. You know, and especially when we're early in the season and they went through a long winter with very limited produce. I mean, if you know, I could sell pallet loads of actually lettuce, oranges, and bananas if I had them on board.
So while the ferry's passengers may think the bakery is the best part of the Chignik stop, and the residents may love the burgers and salads, the Testamina's crew is just glad to see everyone smiling with full stomachs.
It's real fun, and I mean, like I say, I mean, I've been doing it for quite a while now, and, you know, I mean, they're just so happy when they see the McTusty, per se, come in.
For AK and Chignik, I'm Alexander Gutierrez.
And now it's time to tour the state in the segment we call 300 Villages. This week, we visit the interior village of McGrath on the Kuskokwim River.
I'm Ray Collins, and I am the current chair of the Tautac Historical Society here in McGrath. We like a midwinter break somewhere to go somewhere warm for a little while, but we still prefer here, especially as long as it stays roadless, because we can get in a boat and we're out in the road, enjoy the wilderness. You know, pretty much unlimited opportunities for camping wherever you want or fishing wherever you want and so on along the river. It's still the highway in the summertime between the villages a lot, unless you're taking a plane flight. Yeah, and it's the, in the fall time, everybody hunts by river, goes out by river to hunt. And then people do go out and fish. They're more plentiful and fresher downriver. At our peak, we were about 550, and we've dropped down around 400 now, because what happened is after the oil money started coming in, the state started rebuilding airstrips in rural areas. The school district was funded and schools were rebuilt, so on. There's a lot of construction going on, and this was a center for a lot of that, but now a lot of that's phased out now that some of those projects have been completed. Families now are having to move the younger ones for work. So our school numbers have dropped now. We're oversized in our school here. In fact, some of them, we've already closed one at Minchumina and Tulida and Lyon Village. We've closed three schools in this area because of drops in enrollment of young people in enrollment. BLM, first under the federal, started a fire operation here when they started working fire, so it's been the center for that. And then the state took that over now, but they still maintain the fire center here to gear up every summer for fires. Crews are out of here. In fact, some of them are just come back. They were on the Fairbanks fire, but they were geared up here. And then they open the operation here every summer and gear up and keep some standby crew and helicopter here. There's placer operations again, some families that are out, and there's crews out of here that are doing drilling down at Venezuela. They're flying out of here daily by helicopter. They're getting more information on developing the hard rock mine in Venice, what's available there. In the future, they could end up mining that too. And then in the fall, there'll be hunters moving through here, flying out to hunting opportunities either over on the Inoko or up in the Alaska Range.
That was Ray Collins in McGrath. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK on Alaska News Nightly. We had reporting tonight from Alexandra Gutierrez in Chignik and APRN's Josh Edge in McGrath. Tune in every Friday for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Annie Feit. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org or follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Juneau, Jovic Nikki in Petersburg, and Sudio in Talkeetna. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer, Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Timing is everything. A mother who waits until her child is at least 2 years old before becoming pregnant again is making the best decision for herself and her baby. The mother has a better chance of regaining health and energy between pregnancies, and her baby has a better chance of being born on time and at a good weight. Talk to your health care provider to find out how to plan your pregnancies. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.